For example, the US military and the US Army do not report their fuel usage to Congress, let alone itemize how much fuel was spent where or on what war. Most US government accounting of US greenhouse gas emissions omit figures on how much the military contributes, even by a relatively easy-to-track measure like fuel consumption. And consume fuel it certainly does in vast quantities. A 2019 report found that the Department of Defense is not only the largest consumer of energy in the United States, but is also the world's largest institutional consumer of petroleum, and thus the world's largest institutional emitter of greenhouse gases. Between 2001 and 2017, the Department of Defense was responsible for emitting 1.2 billion metric tons of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, equivalent to the annual emissions of 257 million cars. This year, it is expected to burn through 82.3 million barrels of fuel, more than the total oil consumption of Finland. Netta Crawford, political scientist and co-director of Brown University's Costs of War project, said, "The plan aims to supposedly reduce this number, but a more impactful way for the US military to address the scale and pace of its carbon footprint is to simply do less." She points to the fact that the US military has about 800 installations in 80 countries and another 740 military bases on home soil, of which about 315 are army installations. Yet, by its own admission, the Pentagon says the US Army operates a third more bases than it needs. It calls this excess basing capacity. Professor David Vine said, "Far greater savings can be achieved by just closing a base rather than making a base that is unnecessary more energy efficient." Even that kind of thinking would probably not be enough to reduce the armed forces' greenhouse gas emissions as much as is needed, however. Stephen Smith, coordinator at the UN Environment Programme's Disasters and Conflict subprogram, said, "The military's climate impact is not just about the environmental footprint of the military itself, it's also about the way the operations are conducted and the way wars are fought." Stephen Smith added, "War is, by its nature, destructive." For instance, post-war construction uses up a vast amount of resources. According to Hassan Parto, a UN Environment Programme manager, the disposal of rubble and rebuilding from infrastructure destruction is a long, carbon-intensive process. Referring to cleanups that were required in Iraq, Hassan Parto said, "The amount of trucking and emissions that would be required to dispose of this debris is like travelling from the Earth to the Moon multiple times. War also degrades land, altering and reducing its carbon sequestration capacity." Ware said, "The land degradation legacy in Iraq shows that when you change the land and change the soils, that changes the amount of carbon it can store. To what extent is unclear, as it is rarely, if ever, studied. But soil erosion causes carbon loss, and desertification and degradation reduce land's ability to hold carbon, all of which probably happened in Iraq, particularly in what was once marshland." Weir said, "We know so little about how much land is destroyed in this matter," adding, "No one's really following or documenting it." He thinks an even larger contributor to the climate crisis than the emissions caused by fighting is the environmental changes those conflicts create. Of course, the fighting doesn't help. Hassan Parto says some of the first targets in conflict zones are oil infrastructure and electricity-generating power plants. The U.S. military has frequently targeted oil tankers in Syria. The resulting fires give rise to heavy carbon emissions. Hassan Plato added, in the case of Iraq, people could not see the sun from all the emissions. U.S. emissions rose dramatically following the wars in both Iraq and Afghanistan. But even non-violent conflict triggers other carbon emissions. Netta Crawford, political scientist and co-director of Brown University's Cost of War Project, said, when the United States acts to increase its presence in Asia and the Pacific, it alerts the Chinese to the American presence, and they respond by making more weapons, which in turn produce more carbon emissions. But what can be done, rather than only see the climate emergency as a security threat that needs to be trained for, Netta Crawford suggests the U.S. military should help reduce the emergency itself and the instability it will cause. Netta Crawford said a much better strategy than preparing for climate change-caused war is to prevent climate change-caused war. According to Lindsay Kushgarian, Program Director at the National Priorities Project, federal and military budgeting priorities might also need to shift. The White House is expected to request a military budget of more than $770 billion for the next fiscal year. Lindsay Kushgarian added, as long as we continue to push that amount of money into the military, we will not have the resources to deal with climate change. Even so, the U.S. Army Climate Strategy is considered an important document. Professor David Vine says it does reflect a long-standing concern in the U.S. military that actually has been much more progressive and advanced than most of the rest of the U.S. government about global warming and climate change. Netta Crawford added, for example, the move to electrify Army vehicles is significant in the stimulus it gives to manufacturers to produce more electric vehicles and lower their costs in the rest of the country. Richard Kidd, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Environment and Energy Resilience, claimed the Department of Defense will incorporate climate risks in its future strategies as well, including the expected National Defense Strategy, adding, a comprehensive climate mitigation and sustainability plan will be released in the fall. However, the concern remains that these strategies will only treat the symptoms and not marginally. Although the Army Climate Strategy, ACS, highlights the need to act now, it says so four times in the document. The targets are set over another 20 years. To Lindsay Kushgarian, plans like the Army Climate Strategy prompt a bigger question. Can any military goal, such as sustained land dominance by any large military, America's or otherwise, ever be sustainable? Kushgarian notes that there is no such thing as sustainable fast fashion, and there's no such thing as sustainable global military hegemony.
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witch hunt.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Now, if it wasn't enough for the NSA, the FBI, and the DHS to spy on American citizens, the CIA, which is supposed to operate outside of the country, has joined the pact and is spying on U.S. citizens as well. Mass surveillance is being conducted by the CIA on U.S. citizens. The National Security Agency was known to be collecting bulk data with the cooperation of big tech firms. So does privacy really exist in the country? Do Americans even know who is watching them? Are they aware their privacy is being compromised? And what areas of their lives are they being spied upon?
They're watching you.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and in today's episode, we'll discuss mass surveillance and how different U.S. intelligence agencies are spying on Americans. Why is the CIA spying on Americans and operating in the country? How much do Americans know about the type of data being collected from them, and how can they protect their privacy? And how does all this U.S. use foreign intelligence agencies to get away from spying on American citizens? As usual, we're pleased to have our two guests on our program, John Caracal, whistleblower and former CIA counterterrorism officer, and Daniel McAdams, executive director at the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity from Lake Jackson, Texas. Stay tuned.
Turns out that the CIA has been conducting mass surveillance on U.S. soil and has been spying on American citizens for years. A newly declassified letter by two Democratic senators shows that the United States Central Intelligence Agency has been collecting bulk data for years. They say that the data can affect American citizens and their privacy, and that the CIA has been collecting these compromising data without a warrant.
There's a secret CIA surveillance program, and it's allegedly been collecting data in bulk, including information about lots of Americans. That's the accusation from two Democrats on the Senate Intelligence Committee. Senators Ron Wyden and Martin Heinrich say the program has been operating without any oversight, and they're now accusing the CIA of hiding the details about it from the public and from the Congress. The senators are calling on the agency to declassify the information about the program.
And now Senators Ron Wyden of Oregon and Martin Heinrich of New Mexico were the senators that revealed this information in a letter that has not been completely declassified. In that letter, they've asked Avril D. Haines, Director of National Intelligence, and William J. Burns, the Director of the CIA, to declassify these activities and explain the rules and regulations governing the collection of data and information about U.S. citizens. So why is the CIA collecting data from U.S. citizens in the first place?
That sounds like an easy question, but it's actually a difficult one. First of all, the CIA legally is not allowed to collect information on U.S. citizens or anyone called a U.S. person. That is anybody in the country legally on a green card or on an immigrant visa. But since 9/11, it's as though the rules, the laws have just gone out the window. And so all the CIA has to do, whether it's in the courts or before the oversight committees on Capitol Hill, is to say the words national security. And then they're essentially allowed to do anything they want. In this case, what they're doing is vacuuming up as much bulk data as they possibly can, whether it's data from an American or U.S. person or a foreign national. They're storing it in huge Cray computers in the desert in Utah, and they just will deal with the legality of it later.
After the letter by the two senators exposed that the CIA program was completely outside any kind of statutory framework, or without any form of inspection from judicial, congressional, or the executive branch, the American Civil Liberties Union said in a statement that these reports raise serious questions about what information of ours the CIA is vacuuming up in bulk and how the agency exploits that information to spy on Americans. This invasion of our privacy must stop. How can Americans protect themselves from these invasions?
The only protection we do have is the fact that they collect so much, massive amounts of information that they're constantly looking for needles in a haystack. You know, no American should assume that he or she has a bit of privacy in anything we do. It is a kind of surveillance state that we live under, that under, for example, the Stasi or under the Soviet Union, they couldn't even imagine having this kind of surveillance that we have in the United States because the technology wasn't there. We have the technology, and we know now from Snowden, we know from this recent letter that was sent by two senators talking about the secret bulk collection of the CIA of Americans. We know from all of these sources, going back to the Church Commission back in the 70s in the United States, the extent to which we are all under surveillance by our own government, the government that is supposed to be working for us, is actually spying on us.
Edward Snowden, who famously leaked highly classified information from the U.S. National Security Agency in 2013, showing massive surveillance by the NSA and the Five Eyes Intelligence Alliance with the cooperation of tech companies, tweeted, "You're about to witness an enormous political debate in which the spy agencies and their apologists on TV tell you this is normal and okay. And the CIA doesn't know how many Americans are in the database or even how they got there anyway. But it's not okay." So do Americans have any privacy?
Americans have no privacy. None. None whatsoever. Whether it's on your phone, in your emails, in your text messages, on social media, or anytime you're in public, there is no expectation of privacy. You know, there's a court case right now saying that the law about privacy and communications was written before the internet was created. And the law says that the government cannot open your mail. Well, it doesn't say anything about email because email hadn't been invented. Well, the government is arguing that when you write an email and you send it to someone, the company that runs the email or that owns the email, Google, Microsoft, Apple, whatever, they have access to the email, to the contents of it. And so if they have access, the government should have access as well. And so as a result, there is no such thing as privacy in communications.
Glenn Greenwald, an American journalist who first received information from Snowden and then exposed it in The Guardian, also wrote on Twitter that the CIA is a criminal organization. Their interference in U.S. politics is particularly pernicious. Maybe news outlets should stop hiring all of the people who run this agency to help, quote unquote, analyze and report the news. Maybe journalists should be skeptical of their planted stories.
Well, it's a good question. The CIA was set up in 1947 under the National Security Act of 1947. As the purpose of setting up the CIA was to create an organization that could, in one stop, inform the president about things that were happening overseas. It was a response to the end of World War II and the beginning of the Cold War. And after World War II, there were scattered intelligence agencies through the military and elsewhere, the OSS, of course, during World War II. So the idea of this was to consolidate the intelligence collection and analysis capabilities of the U.S. government in one area. And this is signed by President Truman. President Truman did say in his memoirs, if he had known what would have happened to the CIA, what it would have become, particularly in terms of its covert action, he never would have approved it, never would have signed it, never would have brought it into being.
It's nothing new that intelligence agencies in the U.S. spy and gather all the information they can from their citizens. In 2013, Snowden revealed that the NSA was spying on Americans, and later he was forced to seek refuge in Russia for fear of prosecution and imprisonment. At the time, the NSA had gained direct access to the systems of U.S. internet giants like Facebook, Google, and Apple, among other companies. This access was part of a prison program that the NSA used to collect internet communications from various U.S. internet companies. Has anything changed since then?
Well, very little has changed because members of Congress and senators, very, very few of them have shown any stomach whatsoever to challenge what we call the national security state in the United States. And that includes the CIA, the parts of the FBI, and others. You know, when the Snowden revelations came out, there was an uproar. There was a lot of loud noise. And there was some calls for reform. But, you know, reform in Washington always means that you get to keep doing the stuff you were doing. You just call it something else. And so they renamed the Patriot Act, but they kept all of the worst aspects of the Patriot Act and called it the Freedom Act. There's just an example of what they did. So a short answer to your question, very little changed at all after the revelations because Congress had no stomach for it. And the American people are very, very easily distracted by other things.
So, under the PRISM program, officials were collecting material which included but was not limited to search history, content of emails, file transfers, and live chats. Now, these collections were made directly from the servers of major service providers. The actions were made possible by changes to U.S. surveillance laws, which were introduced by former President George W. Bush and later renewed by former U.S. President Barack Obama in December of 2012. So do Americans know what type of data exactly is being collected from them?
Well, I think most Americans realize what the government is doing. The problem is I think most Americans don't care what the government is doing. You know, Joseph Goebbels said something in the 1930s. Why are you worried about it if you haven't done anything wrong? Well, that's exactly the opposite of what our position should be. Our position should be that the government has no business in our communications. It has no business collecting our data, unless it has evidence that a crime has been committed and it goes through the proper channels to acquire that data. But in the meantime, it shouldn't be gathering any information on Americans who have not been accused of a crime in a court of law. You know, we can extend that. We can say that it's not just our communications, but in virtually every aspect of our lives, the government is involved now. You know, it's not just the intelligence agencies either. It's every aspect of government, whether it's DARPA or the FBI or the Drug Enforcement Administration or the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms or the border agencies. We have no privacy.
The program was not only for Americans living in the U.S., but also targeted any customer that participated with these tech firms, whether living in or outside the United States. The spying doesn't just stop there either, because the United States is also a party in a multilateral agreement, which is an intelligence alliance comprising of Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, and the U.S. This alliance is called the Five Eyes, also known as FVEY.
This is a special kind of alliance, a special kind of relationship. And when I say special, what I mean is that these five countries share with each other literally everything. It's not unusual, for example, to have representatives of the Five Eyes intelligence services working in each other's buildings, in each other's headquarters. They give each other complete access to files and to data and technology. They don't spy on one another. It's a relationship of open sharing. Now, that's very dangerous, if you ask me, because not only do I have to worry about my government intercepting my phone calls, my emails, my text messages, but I have to worry about them sending all of my personal data to the Five Eyes countries, which have even less of a right to my information than my own government does.
The Five Eyes goes back to World War II, Some of the activities of this alliance was revealed by Snowden, indicating that the intelligence agencies within the FVEY have been spying on one another's citizens and then sharing the information they have collected with the other members in order to thwart preventive and restraining regulations on surveillance of citizens and essentially leaving the spying on ally intelligence organizations.
Well, the CIA is forbidden by law from spying on American citizens, but one way they get around this is by leaking some of the information to, for example, the Australian intelligence services, and then that is picked up as foreign surveillance. So the Five Eyes are very useful for when the CIA wants to spy on Americans, but technically is not allowed to do that. They go around the other side. So I think Americans should assume that literally everything they do is being watched and listened to and recorded for potential future use. It's kind of a pre-crime.
Now, some politicians have spoken up against these invasions of privacy. Utah Republican Representative Chris Stewart recently said that Congress needs to reassert control over intelligence community's activities inside of America. Stewart added, if you want to build an American KGB, if you think that's a good idea, then keep going down this road. Stewart's worry is mostly because he believes U.S. intelligence agencies are going after white supremacists who are by large in favor of the Republican Party.
The CIA is not allowed under law to spy on Americans directly as such. However, for example, our conversation right now, because you're not in America, that's fair game for them to listen in on, and we must assume that they are listening in on this call and any other overseas call. And even if it's not something they're actively looking, they'll just simply sift it up, and they have massive, massive storage facilities. They'll just store it for a future data. If they want to build a case on someone down the road 10 years, well, they can always look back and see what they were doing 10 years previous. So Americans should assume that they have zero privacy until they wake up and demand that their members of Congress do something to restore. I mean, it's very ironic that America goes around the world blowing things up and lecturing people on how they need to have a democratic government and privacy and civil liberties, when in fact at home we have a scarcity of all of these things and no one seems to give a darn about it. And that's the sick part.
So many feel that the U.S. is essentially a police state. In courts, prosecutors claim to have information and evidence against a defendant that is classified, and that defendant is not allowed to view them. They collect evidence and information by whatever means they please, and if they know the courts may throw them out, they conduct reverse engineering and collect information they already know by other means and use them to prosecute and charge defendants with evidence that they cannot really defend against. And now for this part of the program, we're going to check in with Abbas Montarim.
Assalamu alaikum and Ramadan Mubarak, and welcome back to Power to the People. Today on the show, we will take a look at the root causes of the mass surveillance system that we live in today. And we must understand that the system that we live in, it didn't pop out of thin air, rather it's been developed through centuries of oppression. Surveillance in America, it is literally rooted in the protection of the European-American settler colonizers' property, whether it be land or enslaved people. Surveillance is literally used by the state and its armed guardians, aka the police, the feds, and the military, to protect the interests of the capitalists. And the foundation of surveillance in the so-called United States is in colonialism and shadow slavery. During shadow slavery, surveillance, it was literally used to find Africans who had escaped off of the plantation. Surveillance was led by the police in the South, who were called slave patrollers, and they would literally hunt down and track down Africans who escaped off of the plantation, and they would spy and keep records on enslaved Africans who were quote-unquote causing problems. And this is literally the foundation of policing in this country, specifically in the South, and is the beginning of the surveillance apparatus. And if we look in the North, the police was born out of the history of slavery, but also to bust up and destroy workers' unions. The police use surveillance to destroy unions by organizing mass arrests as well as infiltrating unions. The police use surveillance to identify people that were going against vagrancy and public order laws and then arrest them. The government, they also use privatized officers called Pinkertons who would literally infiltrate unions to destroy them from the inside. These actions by the state, they was rooted in anti-blackness, anti-worker, being anti-communist. Another organization that is responsible for mass surveillance is none other than the FBI, which was created in 1908 by President Roosevelt, who himself was a former NYPD police commissioner. The attorney general at the time, Bonaparte, he hired investigators to report to the DOJ and specifically to report to the chief examiner, Stanley W. Finch. 1 year later, it was renamed the Bureau of Investigation. And in 1935, it was officially known as the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and J. Edgar Hoover, he was the director. Under J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI spied on and destroyed communist movements. It set up and led efforts to destroy Marcus Garvey and ultimately led to his deportation. And the FBI, it used operations, clandestine operations, and surveillance operations against the UNIA. The FBI also played a role in the assassination of MLK, and the US government was literally found guilty for MLK's assassination. Hoover also created the illegal COINTELPRO program, which used disinformation campaigns, assassinations, false allegations, political imprisonment, and a whole bunch of other racist, torturous tactics, all to destroy the Black Power movement. Another organization that uses mass surveillance on the people is the CIA. The CIA, which was founded in July 26, 1947, and evolved out of the OSS, led surveillance operations on the continent as well as Black leaders here in America. The CIA led covert operations and helped the United States recolonize Africa. The three-letter agency is responsible for assassinating Lumumba, El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz, and overthrowing Nkrumah's Pan-Africanist government in Ghana. They also stole uranium from the Congo to build the atomic bomb. And it has led to coups and havoc all over the world through their surveillance and clandestine operations. The CIA has also been secretly conducting massive surveillance programs that capture Americans' private information. And the CIA, they literally openly collaborated with the police departments, especially post 9/11, to target Muslim communities. And another three-letter agency that is responsible for mass surveillance is the NSA. The NSA, which was founded in 1952 and has been spying on the American people en masse. And if we look at the NSA's history, though it was founded in 1952, didn't get revealed to the American public until 1975. So literally our tax dollars was being used to fund surveillance on us and we didn't even know it. Edward Snowden, he whistleblowed on the agency and exposed how the NSA secretly was building a vast database of telephone records so that the agency could spy on people all across the world. The NSA also has the notorious prison program, which tapped into the internet company systems and mass collected user data. All these three-letter agencies that use mass surveillance and cause crimes against humanity. And we really only know to some extent on how far their reach actually goes. If we look at surveillance, it is at the very heart of the United States. It is used to lock up, assassinate, lead disinformation campaigns, and it is used to destroy anyone who goes against the ruling class. And if you live in America, and if you pay taxes, you're literally funding the government's ability to spy on you. And we got no say in it at all. But you know, it's democracy. We voted for this. This is a perfect example of the contradictions of so-called American democracy. We didn't vote for it, but the government, the oppressive government, they chose this for us. And they surveil us, they spy on us, all to keep power and control in the hands of the colonizer and the hands of the capitalists. This is power to the people.
And that was our show, everyone. Thank you. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and do join us again next week for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
in the limelight.
Some U.S. Republicans are calling for Ohio Supreme Court Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor's impeachment because she's refusing to let them distort electoral districts to their advantage. Here we present you an article in this regard written by Sam Levine under the heading, "The U.S. Republican Judge Blocking Her Party from Rigging Electoral Districts." Please stay with us to hear more about the story. In one of the final acts in a 24-year political career, the Republican Chief Justice of the Ohio Supreme Court is defying her party and refusing to let them distort electoral districts to their advantage, a move that has some fellow U.S. Republicans calling for her impeachment. Since January, Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor has served as the decisive vote on three separate occasions blocking Ohio Republicans from enacting proposed state legislative maps. She also sided with Democrats to block an initial GOP proposal for congressional districts before going into effect in January. Those decisions have prompted chatter among Republicans about impeaching O'Connor, 70, who will leave the court after nearly two decades at the end of this year because she has reached the mandatory retirement age for judges in Ohio. O'Connor has a long independent streak. A decade ago, she joined a dissent from the Supreme Court, upheld the state legislative districts drawn by Republicans. She would later say that the decision, "I broke away from the mold in some people's minds," adding, "Party affiliation should not, and people have to understand it should not have anything to do with how a judge does their job." In 2018, she joined with the lone Democrat on the court to dissent from a ruling upholding that forced the closure of the last abortion clinic in Toledo. She has backed criminal justice and bail reform as other Ohio Republicans are pushing to make it harder for someone to be released on bond. She has called for less partisan influence in the way judges are elected in the state. In 2020, just before the presidential election, she blasted the state Republican Party for accusing a local judge for colluding with Democrats, saying the attack was disgraceful and deceitful. Paul Pfeiffer, a Republican who served on the Supreme Court with O'Connor from when she joined in 2003 until he retired in 2017, said, "She's no shrinking violet. She's got sharp elbows," adding, "No amount of public criticism is going to change her mind if she feels that she's right in the position she's taking." William O'Neill, a Democrat who served with O'Connor on the court from 2013 to 2019, said she was the justice he wound up voting with the most. They were the only two members of the court who dissented in 2018 in the Toledo Clinic case. He said she can be swayed to reasonable arguments, adding her legacy is already carved in stone. The stand he's taking is consistent with her entire career. David Pepper, a former chair of the Ohio Democratic Party, claimed she is also one of the most successful politicians in the history of Ohio. She has been elected 5 times statewide, none of which have been close. The then Ohio governor, Robert Taft, picked the former prosecutor to be his running mate in 1998 to add law enforcement experience to the ticket. Once she was elected lieutenant governor, she oversaw the state's Department of Public Safety, taking on a leading role after the suspicious 9/11 attack. She would travel overseas with troops being deployed from Ohio, even though that doesn't typically fall within the responsibilities of her role. Taft said in an interview, "She took the initiative to do that, and I would say it was above and beyond what she would have to do in her role," adding, "She was part of our team, but she was also her own person. She was an independent thinker. She was elected to the court in 2002 and became Chief Justice in 2010.
Now O'Connor and the court are not backing down in their refusal to let Republicans in the state get away with one of the most brazen efforts to gerrymander electoral districts to their benefit. A new provision in the Ohio Constitution requires partisan makeup of the state's 132 legislative districts roughly reflect the partisan breakdown of statewide elections over the last decade, which is 54% Republican and 46% Democrat. However, the three plans Republicans have passed so far, and a fourth one currently pending before the court, would enable Republicans to win a veto proof majority in the legislature in a favorable year for the party. Jen Miller, the executive director of the Ohio chapter of the League of Women Voters, which is involved in suits challenging the plan, said the constitutional violations of the maps that the Ohio Redistributing Commission continues to pass are obvious. Republicans have forged a sneaky attempt to enact their maps. The initial plan the court struck down in January would have given them control of 64.4% of districts. They then submitted a new plan to the court that nominally had required 54-46 split, but several of the districts were barely majority Democratic, essentially toss-ups, meaning Republicans could still win them in a favorable election. After the court rejected that plan, Republicans came back with a third plan that has likely increased the Democratic majority in those districts, which was again rejected by the court. Last month, Republicans submitted a fourth plan that took the same approach. Paul Beck, a retired political science professor at the Ohio State University, said, "It's a pure power play. I think it's almost like they're saying we have the power to do this, and so we're gonna do it." O'Connor has bluntly called out the way Ohio Republicans are abusing the redistricting process. The first time the court struck down the legislative maps back in January, she went out of her way to write a concurring opinion urging Ohio voters to strip lawmakers of their redistricting power entirely. She wrote, "Having now seen firsthand that the current Ohio Redistricting Commission, comprised of statewide elected officials and partisan legislators, is seemingly unwilling to put aside partisan concerns as directed by the people's votes, Ohioans may opt to pursue further constitutional amendment to replace the current commission with a truly independent, nonpartisan commission that more effectively distances the redistricting process from partisan politics. The standoff has left Ohio at a chaotic impasse. Unlike Supreme Court in other states like Virginia that have stepped in to draw maps, the Ohio Supreme Court is prohibited from making its own plan. Early voting began on April 5th without the state legislative districts on the ballot. Last month, a coalition of civic action groups challenged the maps to request that the redistricting commission be held in contempt for failing to comply with the court's orders." The hard line from O'Connor and three other Democrats on the Supreme Court, where Republicans have a 4-3 majority, is extremely consequential. This is the first redistricting cycle the partisan fairness requirements are in effect. Voters approved them overwhelmingly through a ballot measure in 2015. By refusing to accept the Republican maps, O'Connor and the court are setting a precedent that signals how aggressively the justices are going to police partisan gerrymandering.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on March 10th, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the ninth session of the Assembly. The third point that I wish to make in the area of the jihad of clarification is that in this jihad and struggle, the path for the nation's material progress and growth must be distinguished from misleading wrong paths. This is an important issue. In one Friday prayer address many years ago, I spoke of insiders and outsiders. As a result of this speech, some people created a commotion saying, Why do you divide people into insiders and outsiders? That is why the gentlemen who brought this matter up are the ones who have repeated this idea of insiders and outsiders over and over again in different matters. The issue of insiders and outsiders is a fundamental issue. Insiders does not mean the people who are one's relatives, have the same manners, are in the same political party, have the same opinions and the like. Rather, being an insider is defined one's belief in the path of Islam, Quranic teachings, the Islamic faith, and the great movement of the Islamic Republic, for which great sacrifices have been made. This is important. This correct path must be distinguished from misleading wrong paths.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In the struggle for clarification, this issue is important. And the last point concerning the jihad of clarification, this is a warning for ourselves, is that we must know that if the jihad of clarification is not carried out correctly, materialistic individuals will even use religion as a plaything for their illegitimate desires and aspirations. In other words, if we do not do our job correctly, then he for whom only worldly concerns are important, his own world, in other words, his own desires and ambitions, will even put religion at his service. There is a well-known sentence in the Commander of Faithful's letter to Malik al-Ashtar. Imam Ali Salam tells him to employ people with such and such characteristics. He mentions certain qualities and says that Malik must choose, as his colleagues, people with those qualities. After mentioning those qualities, he says, you should have a piercing eye in this matter, because this religion has formerly been a prisoner in the hands of vicious persons. This is astonishing.
You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak are fighting for their political lives. This after it emerged both men were amongst dozens to receive fines from the Met for their part in Partygate, the series of gatherings that took place during the height of COVID restrictions in and around the corridors of British power. Labour leader Keir Starmer led the chorus of voices urging them to go.
But the guilty men are the Prime Minister and the Chancellor. They've dishonoured all of that sacrifice. They've dishonoured their office. This is the first time in the history of our country that a Prime Minister has been found to be in breach of the law. And then he lied repeatedly to the public about it. Britain deserves better. They have to go.
The Chancellor has issued a statement giving his unreserved apologies over the matter. The Prime Minister, however, attempted an explanation of sorts.
There was a brief gathering in the cabinet room shortly after 2 p.m. lasting for less than 10 minutes, during which people I work with kindly passed on their good wishes. And I have to say, in all frankness, at that time, it did not occur to me that this might have been a breach of the rules. But of course, the police have found otherwise, and I fully respect the outcome of their investigation.
Johnson's critics feel the Prime Minister not only failed the British people with his leadership during the peak of COVID, but continued to do so with these fresh revelations.
I'm stunned. In all British history, no Prime Minister has ever been fined by the police before. And this is a law he introduced, that we all spent 2 years basically in self-isolation. And he's just having not just one party, but about a dozen of these parties. And for somebody who makes the law, who is our Prime Minister, to then break it so many times, he shouldn't just be resigning from office. He should be going to prison.
The support being shown to the Prime Minister and the Chancellor will be of cold comfort to those
who lost loved ones during COVID, and the apologies of both men will ring hollow to those who managed to make the ultimate sacrifice and who are now wondering why those who made the rules seemed incapable of following them. Amina Taylor, London.
It's the second time in 7 months that Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein has visited Tehran. The Iraqi diplomat's trip came upon an invitation by his Iranian counterpart, Hossein Amir Abdullahian. The two-hour talks were held behind closed doors, but from what the joint presser suggests, regional security topped the discussions.
We appreciate the role played by the Republic of Iraq in maintaining regional understanding. We also talked about Syria and expressed our opposition to the fact that parts of Syria are still occupied by military bases of other countries without seeking permission from Syria's central government. We also talked about Afghanistan. Iran and Iraq welcome an all-inclusive government in Afghanistan that encompasses all ethnic groups.
Iraq has been mediating talks between Tehran and Riyadh over ways to resume diplomatic ties between the two regional rivals. After more than 5 years of icy relations, Iran and the Arab Kingdom stand on opposition sides in the Saudi war on Yemen, which has been ongoing since 2014, with Iran calling for a ceasefire. The Iraqi foreign minister says a fifth round of talks due in mid-March was suspended, calling on both sides to quickly resume the discussions.
Iraq and Iran's security is tied to the security of the region, so Iraq will continue to play its part as a mediator for dialogues between Iran and Saudi Arabia to hopefully bring the two countries back to diplomatic relations.
The Iranian foreign minister, for his part, thanked Baghdad's constructive role in brokering the Saudi-Iranian talks, saying Tehran is ready to come back to the negotiating table.
We thank efforts made by the Honorable Prime Minister and Foreign Minister of Iraq to resume Saudi-Iranian talks. We welcome this initiative. When it comes to the Saudi war in Yemen, we believe that a sustainable ceasefire, the removal of the humanitarian blockade, and a Yemeni-Yemeni discussion without any foreign intervention could help the Yemeni people decide their fate.
Iraq and Iran are close political and security partners. This partnership was best manifested during the fight against Daesh terrorists in Iraq, when Tehran helped dislodge the terror group there. But when it comes to trade ties, both sides agree that they need to do more, putting the current bilateral trade volume between the two countries at roughly $14 billion. The two sides now agree to take steps to at least double this figure.
Tehran and Baghdad's ties are basically defined by security cooperation. But let's not forget that Iraq was among the countries that maintained their economic cooperation with Tehran in the peak of U.S. sanctions on Iran. Now, this last visit is seen as another step forward in the two sides' trade and security cooperation. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Uncertain times for millions of Brits. A sharp spike in the cost of living combined with stagnant pay rates mean many are counting the pennies and being forced into making stark choices.
I've got a broken back right now with metal screw and bone in my back. And the pain with the arthritis I've got is horrible. And the cost of living, of electric and gas and petrol and food, is horrible. You know what I have to do? Go from shop to buy cut price things which is on sale.
There's going to be people out there that are too afraid to switch on a kettle for some hot water. You know, that kettle is going to cost me 46p to boil. No. No one should be living like this. This isn't the Stone Age. I'm not going down a mine this afternoon. This is 2022.
The signs for British householders have been ominous. Interest rates hitting a record high of 6.2% earlier this year, supply issues associated with Brexit, the global impact of COVID, a spike in energy costs, the crisis in Ukraine, and a hike in national insurance contributions have all contributed. Food bank use amongst